those who recording should know or recall what I said this afternoon. That is, I'm a person who takes feedback from the final delivery stage. In other words, I listen to what I say. And when I hear it, I sometimes change my mind. So what you have on the tape is not necessarily what I think, it's merely what I read. And that is what I thought when I wrote. Several years ago, one of my students reported a devastating incidental finding in his dissertation. He found that human creatures in lecture-type situations were far superior to programmed materials in one respect. Teachers were better at generating irrelevant thought patterns between the minds of the assembled students. And I'm always conscious of that finding, and I know that I was very nervous about this. Nevertheless, I am honored by this opportunity to present the 1972 Bergman Lecture. For the list of previous speakers, it was an impressive one. Moreover, as I said this afternoon, the opportunity to address persons who would become significant others to some many is a challenge laden with responsibility. The pair of lectures is offered under the heading From a Conceptualist Present Viewpoint. Now, this is meant to suggest that although there may be, in fact, it seems almost certain there is an objective external reality to be known, one's knowledge of it is both imperfect and limited. What one knows is dependent on what is experienced, and that in turn is dependent in large measure on the direction in which interests turn one's attention. Further, the data from experience are organized, transformed, and otherwise interpreted by the mind. So one cannot always be certain whether one is acting on the basis of true principles learned from reality, or on the basis of self-made perceptions. The latter, self-made perceptions, may be valid, if at all, only in the restricted area of reality in which one is operating. Although this position helps one avoid becoming a nihilist, as I suggested this afternoon, that is, developing the urge to destroy all present institutions and arrangements under which we live, it has flaws which can lead to similarly devastating consequences. As was pointed out this afternoon, the realist, not the nihilist, the realist is likely to interpret one's language about knowledge as though it were language about reality. At that point, belief and faith become confused with warranted assertion and degrees of confidence, and you can imagine the attendant difficulties. There must be a view of the context for these lectures. This afternoon, the topic was intrahuman views of mind. Tonight, it is engaging the mind and learning. This afternoon, we explored an ever-extending set of views of the mind. Tonight, we will explore implications of these views for the education process. This afternoon, we kept bordering on purposes for an education program. Tonight, we shall stay closer to the actions of a teacher, methodology. This afternoon, we ranged over the training of the reflector, the schooling of the rational, and education of the mind. Tonight, we shall focus on schooling of the rational. If the spotlight becomes elliptical, it will spread in the direction of education of the mind. My purpose throughout the two lectures is to persuade you to extend and entertain a fuller view of the human mind as you work to mold it. Now, the American scene is characterized by a significant shift in the perception of reality. Okay. The label true, with a capital T, has been used too loosely some sense. A couple of homely examples from the early part of the present century in the world of churches and religion. One should make the Lord work for him. It's true, what he said. Therefore, it's a sin to have a windmill pump your water. Now, if you don't like the example from the Amish, let's take one from the loose. One shouldn't gamble. It's true. Therefore, it is a sin to own life insurance. Well, we could extend this list, but we won't. Paradoxically, this loose use has turned out to be confining and restricting, and has contributed to a disenchantment with the underlying philosophy. The attendant revolt against philosophic realism holds implications for education. The implications for the content of schooling, for methodology, even for the purposes set for education institutions, have great concern and great interest to me. But whatever attraction the immediate light from these heated concerns might hold, the focus of all beings is ultimately on the mind. My remarks will deal with the engagement of the mind and learning. The process which I propose to discuss tonight is, of course, instruction. It can't be an inspiring act if it issues in learning by the mind of the student. It is a privileged act to be undertaken only with high moral intent. It is a terrifying act when the potential for misuse is considered. It is a mysterious act involving acting at a distance by one mind on another, often through a medium called instruction and material. It is a thrilling and humbling experience to engage a student's mind in the process of learning. I am a teacher, sometimes a very good teacher, and so I have first-hand knowledge of the limited extent to which teachers actually engage minds in learning. In our typical schools, we do several things which mitigate against our being able to engage minds in the learning that we would like to have in the country. First, we provide them with an artificially and traditionally restricted list of courses they are required to study. Let me call it content. Second, we show little imagination in generating or accepting novel ways of approaching the content. For example, through the consideration of natural phenomena, real human problems, or currently relevant topics. Let me call these things subject matter. Third, we typically attempt to begin instruction at the precision level, omitting the romance level, to borrow from Whitehead. As Professor Dunkel, my colleague, has said with reference to Whitehead, we no longer have spontaneous play. We have organized programs. Thus, the old-fashioned ball game we call a workout has given way to little league. The homemade soft drink stand has been largely replaced by junior season. Not that the organized programs are by definition bad, but they increase the pressure to squeeze the romance phase out of much that children used to do just for fun. As parents of First World War II children, we often wonder what our generation has done with children to generate the current scene. Our conclusion is, one thing we did was to instill idealism in them. But what we may have done wrong was squeeze the fun, the spontaneity, the white-headed romance out of the lives and education of our children. And now the search for this exploratory base for learning pops up in the young adult. It apparently can be postponed, but not denied. But enough polemic rhetoric and confession from a member of the confused generation. As contrasted with the confining and restricting courses of study that I have been suggesting, let us consider the magnificent, versatile, boundless mind with which, as teachers, we do it. Now I would like to enumerate a few characteristics which I didn't touch on this afternoon. Professor Bruner suggests that we have three techniques for representing reality: action, imagery, and symbolism. These are derivatives of an ancient side of modes, inactive, iconic, and symbolic. Although these are treated as sequential stages of development in the human, there is evidence that persons revert to earlier stages when learning new concepts. Thus, tinkering around with equipment in the physics laboratory, moving objects around on mats, and dancing or acting out concepts such as tall, relaxed, and space have some relevance to a coherent view of learning stemming from a motor theory of mind. Shifting to a quite different view of mind, we think that Professor Sturman's notion is probably correct for some learners in some content areas. Assuming the mind can comprehend experience, his idea is that it operates two fundamental processes, On the one hand, it reduces relations among things. For example, presented with two apples, the relation same will appear in mind. And on the other hand, given a thing and a relation, it reduces a chorus. For example, presented with an apple and the relation same, another apple will appear in mind. Then, of course, M. Halder and Piaget offer a developmental model of mind. You are undoubtedly familiar with some of the extensive list of studies that their work has taught. But the processes of mind extend beyond the typical cataloging of rational processes. We make judgments quickly and accurately over an enormous range of qualities. A fine piece of furniture is judged to have an infinitesimal wave and finish by simply passing the fingers lightly and quickly over the surface. An imminent increase in the breeze on the lake is detected by notice of cat paws racing across the surface of the water. A brilliant mechanic listens to an engine and knows you have cheap paraffin oil in it. And alongside the making of judgments are other characteristics of mind, neither easily cataloged nor analyzed. One such is suggested by Ruth Berman's sound stage. After suggesting the lit globe appearance of the setting, she says, "Within the lit globe stands no one, no look, no drawn or slack muscle, no edging of the voice left in minds of men, who if there might be hungry, sleepy, or inappropriately passionate. They are shut out of the globe into some rabbit hole space of time of the mind. Nor are the fictional ones personated there. There, only the body moving in the light, bright dust motes dancing on soft mats, within the globe, within the twilight, within the unseen wall." We are reminded by sound stage that art is the realm of suggestion, and the mind seems acquiescent to lingering in that realm. Professor Charlton provides the basis for an interesting challenge when he suggests four kinds of imagination: historical, mathematical, pictorial, and poetic. Can each of us and every one of our students learn to use this variety of imaginative thinking? If so, ought we to hold this as a purpose of education? The past president of the National Council of Teachers of English, James Miller, supported the development of imagination in his recent presidential address on imagination and the health of every man. And Professor Charlton leads one to believe that he thinks so. He says, "Now here is a rich and complex area of experience, one which man alone can achieve. That is, the ability to perceive a thing and to experiment with situations not present to the senses. And an ability which has been crucial to the development of man. Why, then, has it been so neglected in education, especially at the secondary and higher levels, as something not academically respectable? This capability of mind, imagination, should provide the basis for countless attempts to engage the minds of students and learners." It is with some hesitation that I move now to a study of an intraverbal learning task in order to illuminate the staggering possibilities of the mind as contrasted with our feeble attempts to engage it. Frustration has met most attempts to apply to human verbal learning conclusions from intraverbal learning studies. But this study does display a potential of the mind. If one were to receive the elements L-L-I-I-L-L-I-I visually, while simultaneously hearing the complementary and conflicting elements R-I-L-L-I-I-L-L, this would represent an incompatible presentation. You would be seeing one thing and hearing another. Seeing and hearing, or feeling and hearing, or seeing and feeling, that is, receiving the same sequence of elements in two modalities, would be a compatible presentation. Now, slow rate of presentation, one or two elements per second. L-L-I-I-N. Seems to permit focusing on the individual elements and the learning of patterns. L-I-I-L-I-I. Fast rate two, three, or four elements per second. Force the perception of pattern. When patterns are learned rather than perceived, presentation of the pattern in two modalities does not improve pattern identification. But when patterns are perceived, which is at the higher rate of speed, compatible and incompatible presentation produce faster pattern identification. How the mind handles this is beyond me. Pattern perception at high speed brings us to the end of our initial consideration of the potential of mind this evening. It also reminds me of a situation I once observed, a situation which tempers the view that a teacher will, through dogged determination, succeed in engaging every mind beneficially. This was a beginning class in rapid reading. All the students were adept. The experienced teacher was attempting to establish new reading habits, and so was pressing the class to move over the pages at rates which were increasing exponentially. There were the usual grumblings, and finally, one elderly gentleman protested mildly, but forthrightly. When the teacher asked what the trouble seemed to be, the gentleman, pointing to the page, said that he just couldn't focus on the individual letters of each key. Alas, that mind was habituated on assumptions so different from those of the teacher that it would have been futile to pretend that any engagement for the purpose at hand could have been accomplished. Now then, engaging the mind. The obvious solution to the problem of how to engage the mind is to make it curious. But help in implementing this suggestion is difficult to obtain from psychology. One group would say something about helping students achieve closure. Another would remind us of libidinal drive. Yet another might talk about reducing conflict. But help at this level of abstraction seems to raise additional questions and provide little by way of specific suggestions. In contrast, an acquaintance tells me that over the years he has collected an interesting set of toys and devices which have fascinated his children and his students. These items have one common characteristic. They apparently violate some physical law which the children know intuitively. A small figure suddenly does a backflip in a stationary position. A curved piece of cardboard apparently becomes longer than an identical one. A piece of wood rolls uphill. Such phenomena violate the expectations of the children, and the resulting interest in trying to find out why seems to stem from curiosity. A chemistry teacher once told me that he performed some of his experiments in his top jacket pocket. The class could only see the top of his chest tube, and occasionally the chemicals and other materials that he was putting in. If they didn't ask about the experiment later, or if they didn't perform it themselves, the result remained a mystery. The second suggestion for engaging minds is to provide them opportunity to develop dedication, a passion for working towards some goal. Consider the enormous outpouring of energy to prepare to serve in programs such as the Peace Corps and VISTA. The validity of this suggestion seems so evident at this point in the history of our country that we can't pursue it further here. However, the earlier reference to White Hood and Roman is relevant to this particular suggestion. The third suggestion for your consideration is to lead the student to consider the completeness of the concept he displays. For example, the number 246 conforms to the following rule or concept. Three numbers in increasing order. But given these numbers and told to discover the rule, students displayed an interesting dichotomy of behavior. Those who announced an incorrect rule did so after trying only the simple enumeration of confirming evidence. For example, they would determine that the number set 12, 14, 16, and 6, 8, 10 were compatible with the rule to be discovered, and would then announce incorrectly that the rule was consecutive even numbers, or the second number is the average of the other two. Those who announced the correct rule at the first try tended to test examples which eliminated more possibilities and generated more negative instances. Thus, they might find that 3, 5, 7 conformed to the rule, and that 8, 10, 8 did not, before announcing what they thought the rule was. And so Mr. Rosen, who did this particular study, suggests ways in which some minds reach erroneous conclusions and others reach more accurate conclusions given the same test. Another study which comes to mind demonstrates that minds get trapped in redundant cycles of questions while trying to solve a problem. The subjects in this study were medical students attempting to establish a diagnosis. Some kind of mindset seemed to make them unable to use, apparently unable to believe, the information they were receiving. They were led to ask the same series of questions again and again, unable to move further toward the establishment of a diagnosis. Again, perhaps, the difficulty was an incomplete concept in the student's mind. Now, these kinds of things can be used as a basis for engaging these minds in instruction, pointing out to them what they're doing. Trying to get them to think of ways to avoid doing this, because obviously they're not getting anywhere with it. One of the myriad miracles of creation which fascinates me is the occult operation of the mind. By occult, I mean that which usually goes unnoticed and seems to have no explicable base in or connection to what we know. I think some things I suggested this afternoon would be examples of this category. Helping students develop an awareness of such operations provides yet a third category of methods for engaging minds in learning. Let me offer some examples of what might be considered occult operations. For the first example, we turn to the report of an experiment entitled On Understanding Logically Complex Sentences. The author contends that there are two words spelled S-O-N-E. One of these words is pronounced som, and tends to occur with type nouns. For example, John says that some of his players are tired. There is another word, pronounced some, which tends to occur with math nouns. For example, John says giving to math. I think it's certain that John never studied the word some. Yet he and his friends probably use it regularly to convey restricted, specific information different from that conveyed by the other words, S-O-M-E. How do things like this occur? And why don't we take more notice of them? I presume one has to be able to build a very large number of lessons in language and linguistics about these kinds of phenomena. It's just floating around about us every day. A more popularly known example of this phase of mind comes from transactional analysis and the hypothesized games that minds play. We set this concept this afternoon. One can be astounded to learn that, for example, a teacher plays the adult role opposite her student's child role, not only with 10-year-olds, but with 20-year-olds, not only in the classroom, but in the home and elsewhere. Or that one may slide from an adult role to a child role, unknowingly in particular situations. Since these games seem to pervade interactive human experience, awareness of the role one is playing ought to be usable as an engaging procedure for a very wide range of instructions. Studies using hypnosis provide a rich source of examples of the occult qualities of mind. But lest I be accused of drawing from situations outside the typical experience of students and teachers, I will circumvent such studies. However, I am reminded of a story about World War II. This was toward the end of the war, it was the Battle of the Bulge, and the supplies were getting very short, both on the American side and on the German side, at least in the Mayo area. An American soldier was sent up to the front to fight, and he went to the front, and they arrived at the orderly room or tent or whatever it was, and his commanding officer said, out there in the front lines and fight. And the fellow said, well, I have a rifle. And so the commanding officer grabbed the boom and handed it through and he said, here, use that. And the
And he says, well, what do I do with that?
And he says, you put it under your arm, you say, bang, bang, bang. Bang, bang, bang. And Father said, all right. And he went out. He came immediately and said, well, what if we get in hand-to-hand combat? And the officer grabbed himself and entered the room and crouched to the other end and says, stab, stab, stab. And so he went out. Nelson arrived at the front lines and the Germans began to approach. And then what else he did? Stuck his wound on the gun, said bang, 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 and the Germans fell down. So he continued, bang, 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 the Germans fell all that. All except one, he just kept coming. And when he got very close, he told him, stab, stab, stab. The Germans paid no attention, kept right coming, knocked him down, stomped on him, and kept right on going. The American rose up and looked around just in time to hear the German say, "Hankity tank tank." By means of a poem published in the London Sunday Times, I will conclude this foray into occult operations of the moment. This poem is entitled Hints on Pronunciation for Foreigners. I take it you already know of tuff and bow and cough and dough. Others may stumble, but not you, on hiccup, thorough, laugh, and true. Well done. And now you wish perhaps to learn of less familiar things. Beware of heard a dreadful word that looks like beard and sounds like bird. And bed, it's said like bed, not bead. For goodness sake, don't call it bead. Watch out for meat and grape and fret, they rhyme with fruit and state and bet. A moth is not a moth and mother, nor both and bother, broth and brother. And here is not a match for there, nor deer and fear for bear and pear. And then there's dose and rose and moon, just look them up. And goose and tree and cork and work and card and ward and font and stunt and word and sword and blue and gold and fort and cart. Come, come, I hardly know a start. A dreadful language? Man alive, I'd mastered it when I was five. Well, we now turn specifically to instruction, and more particularly, individualized instruction. In our fantasies, we see, on the one hand, individualized, computer-assisted, multimedia programmed instruction. These situations attract students by offering them privacy for testing hunches and hypotheses and for charting interest and skill attainment as they learn. They offer an array of challenging problems around which to develop learning and a nearly inexhaustible supply of audio and visual aids to learning. For the human teacher, we fantasize a dialectician who engages the individual student in a discussion which leads him to ever deeper insight. But in reality, programmed instruction materials have a deadening, heavy quality to them. Few, if any, options are open to the learner. And teachers seem hardly to know anything to do save its time. The facile mind tipping nimbly among brilliant, stimulating questions and thinking, illuminating illustrations is seldom in evidence. What, pray tell, can be done? Well, although some suggestions have already been offered, let us review some additional ideas that have been attempted or suggested. I enjoyed the privilege of working for several years on a project designed to improve the teaching of hematology in several medical schools in this country. The first rule established for the experimental teaching procedure program was that no one would be permitted to lecture. For a moment, reflect on what that rule would mean to individualized instruction involving the pupil and the teacher. What could transpire in this circumstance? Many things. For example, they could create or select and explore problems together in a particular area. The teacher might attempt to help the student develop understanding via careful questioning. In the hematology classes, the students were given classic cases from the files of hematology. These cases were tasked as case problems. The student was given some information, then asked to do something, such as order a laboratory test, suggest questions to ask the patient, interpret physical findings, and so forth. At each step, to commit himself. And then we have the official answer as the student came to call it. That is, what was actually done with the patient. This proceeded until a diagnosis was reached. Later in the week, the student could ask about or challenge any decisions which had been reported in the case problem, or inquire as to why his suggestion was inappropriate. This is a very successful method of engaging minds in learning. We made some of the students very angry because they knew there was another way to do this. Wouldn't allow them to answer the questions on the examination, and that's what they wanted to do. They had gotten lazy in the education process of the last 20 years. You can only go up. At this point, we turn to our earlier consideration of conceptions of the mind to explore some procedures suggested by beliefs about mind. The example I'm about to give is based on some work currently being pursued in the field of nutrition. Suppose you had a test of teaching a young obese adult that sodium ions tended to retain fluid in tissue, and that, consequently, a high sodium diet was possibly harmful to him. Now, there are ways of saying this which are less abstract. But suppose you have translated this idea into less abstract English, and there is still evidence of lack of comprehension. What then? You could turn to illustration, both verbal and pictorial. But suppose these efforts fail. According to the modal model of mind, you have tried to have the patient operate at the symbolic and iconic level, that in those modes. But you still have available the most primitive mode, the enactive. Somehow, you try to encourage the patient to act out some meaning for the idea. This is not psychodrama, but rather some kind of muscle and sensory involvement that seems to help by providing meaning to the patient. This level of operation has two sound bases. First, some concepts are difficult to verbalize. And of course, this varies with the knowledge of the related field. Second, some thoughts seem too threatening to be verbalized. In fact, some ideas apparently cannot even be held in consciousness to be thought about. We all have some of those. My point is that most of us operate at this lowest level, the inactive mode, sporadically, with some thought. So let us not associate this mode only with the lesser educated learning syndrome. Perhaps a more specific example will help. At a dinner one evening, the wife of an acquaintance told of the tribulations of raising teenage daughters. It seems that the younger of her girls, aged about 16, had begun to keep an untidy room. Banners and homemade decorations began to appear, hung from the ceiling, and it was getting distracting, if not dangerous, to move about in the room. But mother held her tongue and left things alone for the most part. Then one day, as she was about to enter the daughter's room, mother was confronted with a net hung loosely from the ceiling and filled with inflated balloons. As she stooped low to make her way into the room, a thought struck her. She don't want me in here. That's what she's been trying to say to me all along with these chapters. And indeed, so it seemed. The teenager had been operating in the inactive mode, hoping that mother would receive the intended message in the same mode. And she did. Returning to our obese patient, there's yet another possibility to train the patient into patterns of habit which serve the desired end. But we've seen then that there are several levels or modes of instruction which a teacher might use in the case of a patient trying to learn how to avoid a single substance detrimental to his health. The effectiveness of some of these levels seems dependent on the stage of development of the patient's mind, and this must be determined directly by trying to have him operate in a specified mode. Now, I had the opportunity to present an extended version of this to the Mountain Dietetic Association in November, and the chief of the dietetic clinic at our clinic presented a parallel paper, which was a series of case studies. The various kinds, some of these were patients who had been classified by modality, and there were other classifications of learning. So this kind of classification of the learners and the use of these kinds of things has already been demonstrated. Not thoroughly, but quite satisfactorily in nutritionist cases. This set of modes for learning and instruction is also related to one line of thought about reading, and acts also at the symbolic level. This line of thought or theory suggests that reading is a process of searching in memory for appropriate meanings for the printed symbols being used. To the extent that this is an accurate theory, learning to read involves the development of meaning, which can be associated with the words or printed symbols. Most of the instruction in this process, that is, developing meaning, would profitably be carried on below the symbolic level, at the iconic or the enactive level. The usefulness of some individualized instruction would then seem apparent. For the more primitive or fundamental the mode of instruction, the more natural and individual bound it is. But one of the more generalizable forms of learning, such as how to generate a generalization, or how to sort warranted from the unwarranted inferences, I contend there is need to work at developing them. As background here, please permit me to report the findings of an informal study I conducted over several years, beginning about 1951. The subjects ranged from high school freshmen to candidates seeking entrance to a master's degree program at a university not in the Midwest. On an examination requiring interpretation of data, neither the mean, nor the range of scores, nor the pattern of scores on specific skills differed significantly between the entering high school group and those who had completed college. Some of the skills involved were: noting this statement was not supported by the data, identifying accurate generalizations, and sorting qualified from unqualified extrapolations and interpolations. All scores indicated lots of room for improvement. An academic speech I heard recently is the source of a story which may further illuminate my case. It seems that recently an elderly but sprightly lady was making her first trip in an airplane. She boarded the giant jet with some trepidation, but began to pick up courage and travel off there as soon as the plane took off from its Midwestern home airport. After they had traveled about an hour toward the west coast, the pilot announced that one of the four motors had just failed, but there was no real problem. The plane could easily make it to the coast, although they would be about 2 hours late. Over Colorado, the pilot announced that a second motor had just failed. Again, he said there was no cause for alarm. The plane could easily fly to the coast on the two remaining engines. Of course, the flight would take an additional 2 hours under these circumstances. As the plane just crossed Utah, the pilot announced a most unusual event. The third motor failed. Quickly, he assured the passengers that there was no danger, that the plane could still complete the flight on but one engine. Of course, he apologized. Yet another 2 hours or so would have to be added to the flight plan. At this announcement, the little old lady turned to her neighbor and exclaimed, "Goodness, I hope that fourth engine doesn't fail, or we'll be up here all night." So much for extrapolation. The subjunctive mode and the development of such skills as generating or identifying qualified inferences could be used as a basis for engaging individual minds in learning in every field of knowledge with which I am acquainted. Before closing, let me cast my remarks in a different light. It should be obvious that the main thrust of instruction in most of our educational institutions is toward developing only the rational faculty of human mind. And even this thrust is typically throttled in two ways. First, an arbitrary and limited set of content is operated on, and second, most effort seems to be used in learning information. My belief is that we can, ought, and must extend our efforts to help minds develop more of their potential, not only in the rational sphere, but also in skill development and in the realm of feeling. I have pointed to some suggestions primarily in the rational sphere this evening, and perhaps you can see how much work needs doing. This work would benefit from the engagement of minds in individualized instruction, but some accomplishments might be achieved through better engagement in more conventional class arrangements, and some phases of the work might be successfully induced in mass practice. I'm reminded of some of the work in the 8-year study again, or in particular, a little exercise called interpretation of data, to which I have referred. This text is analyzed not only for a range of accuracy scores, but for